Welcome to Dig, a history podcast. In East Riding, Yorkshire, between 1363 and 1364, adult women harvest workers earned 71% of the wages that adult men did for the same manual labor. In 1970 Britain, women earned 70% of the hourly rate of men. As recently as 2018, women earned 86% of what men did in the hourly wage if they worked full-time. Now, these figures are obviously not perfect comparisons. The first is super specific in geography and type of work, and the others are general, national, and cover all kinds of waged labor in the 20th century and into the 21st. The first is a measure of the 14th century economy, which had little in the way of waged labor to begin with. And the others are set in the 20th century and the 21st, at the end of Britain's industrial era, and in which most work outside the home was compensated in some way. While imperfect, these numbers might pique your interest. Are these isolated figures? If they are, what do they tell us about these moments? And if they aren't, what happened between them? What came before? And what does a persistent gender wage gap tell us about history?
Spoiler alert, these are not isolated figures, but fairly consistent trends across at least 700 years. Starting in the late 1990s, historians like Deborah Simonton and Judith Bennett argued that if we take a step back and look at the long durée of women's history, the evidence suggests that even as Europe's economies transform from marketplaces to market economies, women's work and the value placed on gendered labor was and continues to be remarkably and frustratingly consistent. There was not, in fact, a transformative moment ushered in by capitalism, industrialization, or post-industrialization for women. Even when factoring in race, urban-rural divides, and class, European and American women's labor was always valued less than men's, whether in the household economies or guilds of the medieval period, or on the factory floors of the industrial era, or in the office cubicles of our more recent history. Today, we're going to take a step back and look at the longer history of the gender wage gap, where we can see the continuity in women's work from the 14th century to the present. I'm Averill Earls.
And I'm Elizabeth Garner Masaryk.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig.
We want to thank all of our Patreon supporters, and especially our fabulous auger and excavator level patrons: Hannah, Carl, Colin, Denise, Jessica, Edward, Lauren, Karen, Iris, Susan, Maria, and Lisa. We can't thank you enough. Listener, if you're not yet a patron of this show, it's easy. Just go to patreon.com/digpodcast to learn more.
Before we begin, we want to acknowledge that each of our episodes relies on the research and writing of historians and other scholars. When we first proposed our essay on continuities to Perspectives Magazine, friend of the show and Perspectives managing editor Laura Ansley texted me to say that our pitch reminded her immediately of Judith Bennett's 2002 History Matters, which Laura had read in grad school. Though I am not a medievalist by any stretch of the imagination, I too was familiar with Bennett because her book on Brewsters in 14th and 15th century England formed the basis for my witchcraft and beer episode from a trillion years ago. I hadn't read History Matters, though, and Laura's suggestion immediately piqued my interest. In History Matters, Judith Bennett issued a call for grappling with continuity in feminist histories. It seemed too perfect not to make her case study from the book, which is on the gender wage gap, the focus of my episode. Though published over 20 years ago, her arguments still feel very relevant. She emphasized the importance of pre-modern studies in revealing the continuities in women's lives, not because, like a recent AHA president suggested, we need to stop doing history that has connections to the present, but instead because we need to study the past and the deep past to understand the present, especially in gender and women's histories. She also insisted that we need to bring the language of patriarchy back into our scholarship. So for this episode, I started with Bennett, Simonton, and responses to their works, and then I turned to area studies. I also follow Bennett's breadcrumbs to a number of medievalists whose insights into guilds, marketplaces, women's wage labor in agrarian and urban occupations, family structures, and the household economy were revelatory to me. So I hope that they will be to you as well. You'll find a full bibliography and notes for this episode at digpodcast.org.
I opened this series with an episode on the experiences of gendered wages, wage gaps, and exploitation of reproductive labor under capitalism. There is, as I argued in my episode, a clear thread of continuity in the experience of exploitation under capitalism, particularly for Black women, but also women in general. There is, after all, no capitalism without enslaved and underwaged labor, the uncompensated and unvalued care work performed primarily by women and gendered as feminine, and exploitation. That was true in 1619, 1776, and 1861, and it is still true right now. But what Judith Bennett and other medievalists have shown is that a lot of these conditions are not specific to capitalism, even though capitalism relies on them.
Historian Judith Bennett synthesizes the scholarship on the gender wage gap from 1350 to 1700, using dozens of medieval and early modern studies of laborers, wages, and gender in England and Europe. From her work, we learn that the gender wage gap across professions, social classes, urban-rural divides, and centuries was consistent. Women earned between 50 and 75% of what men earned in Europe over the last 700 years. This wage gap was a general rule in the wage labor market, and even when men and women were doing the same work.
Similarly, Deborah Simonton argues the same for the period 1700 to the present. Both Bennett and Simonton demonstrate that in the household economy, the types of work undertaken by women, the involvement of women in guilds, and the real wages paid to female workers remained constant from the 14th century to the 21st century. While England's economic system, political society, social hierarchies, and national sense of identity changed dramatically in those 650 years, in many ways, including in how their labor was valued, or rather was not valued, women's lives did not change.
Since Friedrich Engels first critiqued capitalism's impact on women and the family, there have been two dominant theses about the history of women's labor, of European women's labor. The first, proposed by scholars like Alice Clark in her 1919 Working Life of Women in the 17th Century, was that prior to industrialization, European women's work was vigorous, regarded as competent and enterprising, and valued in the pre-capitalist household economy. In Clark's estimation, industrialization devalued women's labor and disrupted a golden age of women's work. Conversely, but following sort of the same logic, other historians like Ivy Pinchbeck, writing in 1930, argued that the Industrial Revolution reshaped domestic life, offered women waged work in ever-bettering conditions, and an improved status from the quote-unquote Dark Ages. Both Clark and Pinchbeck proposed that there was a major transformation in European women's lives, and that transformation was ushered in by the engines of capitalism. Whether it was the medieval period or the industrial era, numerous historians have asserted that there was a golden age of women's labor, and that capitalism and industrialization had an impact on it one way or the other.
This idea that the medieval period was a quote-unquote golden age for working women and that the early modern period ushered in a period of decline is a popular feminist myth. Marjorie McIntosh's Working Women in English Society, 1300 to 1620, argues that medieval businesswomen of independent authority in trades and crafts, so things like brewing and money lending, suffered a real loss in the 17th century with the emergence of capitalism. But in her pointed rebuttal of this mythology, Judith Bennett argues that the status of women in their work remained the same between 1350 to 1700. In that time, women's work was considered less skilled and less valuable, as in the case of brewing ale, than the trades of men. So in other words, if it was women's work, it was probably unprofitable.
As some of you will remember, Judith Bennett charted a shift in the profitability of brewing ale and beer in the late medieval period. As the demand for the brew grew, what had once been a side hustle business for women shifted into a profession that could be extremely profitable. Once it was a viable occupation in which one could earn enough money to only do that one job, women were pushed out of the industry by men. Medieval brewers and other men spread rumors about their women competitors, passed laws that made it illegal for women to be in public houses where ale was sold, and issued sermons about the moral danger pubs posed to women's chastity and virtue.
The belief that the medieval household economy was more egalitarian than the industrial household is another popular myth supporting the idea that the medieval period was a golden era for laboring women. Women contributed to, and were essential to, the success of the businesses run out of households. But as Bennett notes, women's work was always less valued than men's work. Married men typically held one occupation, and that was the occupation of the household. But to make the household economy work, women had to supplement with multiple jobs, including raising livestock, selling food, brewing ale, making clothing, and also taking care of the children, preparing meals, and keeping the house, and sometimes even overseeing servants, right? Which is another job in itself. These were not the markers of a world in which women's labor was valued and equal to that of men, and contemporaries were well aware of the inequalities of the medieval economy.
When, for example, in 1363, the city of Exeter passed a law that allowed women artisans to follow multiple trades, even as it restricted men to just one, they codified generally accepted truths that men would be able to subsist on a single occupation income as their labor was adequately valued, but that women doing the same trades would receive less money for their crafts, lower wages for their work, and less status in these organizations, just as was the case in the so-called household economy. As Bennett puts it, quote, "For women, the medieval household economy was not an egalitarian refuge that capitalism and industrialism somehow cruelly undermined."
Guilds, a foundation of the late medieval economy, were a place where women could have, in theory, been compensated equally for their work. But in reality, women were never truly equal members of guilds. Even widows, who were granted the power to oversee guild workshops, hire apprentices, and participate in some guild social occasions, were not equal to their male peers. As Bennett notes, they were effectively just placeholders until the next generation of men was ready to take over. They weren't franchised, their participation in guild ceremonies was limited, and their numbers were always small. Many scholars have argued that modernity and the end of guilds was a major blow to working women, but Bennett argues that women's roles within guilds were as marginal and undervalued as in every other work setting. The exceptions, women-only textile guilds in Rouen, Paris, Cologne, and Nordlingen that flourished into the 18th century just proved the rule.
Several historians, like James Thurlow Rogers, William Beveridge, and Simon Penn, argued that men and women's wages were equal in the 14th century after the 1348-49 plague had killed anywhere between a third and a half of England's population. Rogers, Beveridge, and Penn, writing in the 1880s, 1950s, and 1980s, respectively, all claim that unskilled workers could and did earn the same wage, no matter their gender. But their assertions lacked detailed quantitative data. Sandy Bardsley, on the other hand, conducted an analysis of a detailed wage list from 1363 to 64 and demonstrated that a fully grown adult woman could make as much as a male laborer, as long as that male was disabled or a child. The wage gap in 1330, 1360, and 1400, and so on, was consistent. Women only earn between 50 and 75% of what men earn throughout that period. That wage gap has been consistent also in Europe from at least the medieval period through 2002. In the 22 years since Bennett published History Matters, it has been closing, slowly, in the UK, but still persists. The gender devaluation of women's labor is apparently a hard custom to end.
Historians, of course, have theories about why women earned less wages than men in the medieval period. Some, like Joyce Burnett and John Hatcher, suggests that women's wages reflects their quote-unquote lower productivity in the medieval and early modern waged workforce. Hatcher argues that women were less productive because of their biology, that they were weaker and had more family distractions. Burnett argues that social conditions prevented women from being productive equals to men. Women had fewer education opportunities, fewer opportunities to learn skilled work, and generally received or consumed poorer nutrition. In effect, these scholars argue that the wage gap was simply reflective of a market wage, in which women's labor was measured as worth less because of their deficiencies.
Other scholars, like Donald Woodward and, of course, Judith Bennett, argue that the wage gap cannot be explained by the logic of market forces, but that instead, the undervaluing of women's work was the custom of European patriarchal culture. As Woodward put it, quote, "The low rates of pay given to most women in the early modern period were rooted in convictions, underscored by biblical authority, about their physical, economic, social, intellectual, and political inferiority, which has characterized English society into the present century," end quote. In other words, it was the customary practice to underpay women, including for the same work that men were doing. That custom was established because the patriarchal European Christian churches and thus society were built on an ideology of women's inferiority in relation to men.
Coverture, or the English common law practice of the femme covert, erased a woman's legal personhood on marriage to a man. And Marissa wrote a great episode on coverture years ago, so you check that out in our backlog if you haven't already. As a custom that stretched from the 11th century to the 20th century, and really it still lingers around in the 21st, coverture forced women to surrender all of their property and wages to their husbands. As outlined in the treatise on the law and customs of the realm of England, commonly called Glanville, quote, "Since legally a woman is completely in the power of her husband, her dower and all of her property are clearly deemed to be at his disposal," end quote. At the point of marriage and throughout the marriage, women's businesses and labor were considered supplementary to their husbands. Though some women could register as femme sole or unmarried for business purposes, this mostly only happened in London and a handful of towns. As Bennett notes, registering as femme sole for business purposes didn't necessarily alter the household economy, but allowed her to trade or produce independent of her husband, and the custom seems likely to have developed to free husbands of their wives' debts rather than to support the economic independence of wives.
I also make my students listen to the coverture episode in just about every class I teach that even remotely touches on European gender history, which is pretty much all of them, even when it isn't. Mm-hmm. Coverture was a product of the customs that marked women as inferior to men, thus undermining their potential economic power and public/political positionality. Laws in medieval Western Europe were shaped by layered and complicated adoptions of Roman law, Judaic Old Testament law, and the customs and laws of the various barbarian, quote-unquote, kingdoms that settled in places like France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. Coverture likely had Norman origins, entering the British Isles by way of the 1066 Norman conquest. Even though they shared interactions and legacies of the Roman Empire and in most kingdoms, Judeo-Christian traditions, all of these ethnic groups had their own customs that they issued into laws and edicts and then adapted as was practical when challenged by valued subjects, aka men. The early medieval status of women in these law codes varied across the Western continent and British Isles.
For example, widows could pose a particular problem for early modern men. Widows were rarely, if ever, simply inheritors of their husbands' estates and property, unless their husbands had the forethought to jump through legal hoops to make that so. But medieval kingdoms had laws that protected widows, in part because the Bible framed widows as the person most in need of protection. Visigothic law made widows the guardian of her children, which was not always a given, as under some Roman laws. Anglo-Saxons provided for a widow who had children with assurances that her husband's property and family home would provide for her. The Rothari in Italy allowed widows to be retrieved by her father or brothers as long as they took over guardianship of her. Lex Ribuaria gave a widow 50 solidi and one-third of everything the couple had worked together. But when it came to inheriting her spouse's property, most medieval law codes only granted her her dower or husband's property for her lifetime, or until her children came of age.
And various medieval kingdoms had provisions to control women, not just in what was theirs, but in how they used their bodies. As Janet Nelson and Alice Rio note, quote, Visigothic law required the widow, if she wanted to keep all her property, to wait for at least a year before remarriage. Lombard law allowed the widow on remarriage to keep her dower, provided her new husband handed over half of its value to the first husband's relatives. In England, the second code of Cnut, 1020 and 1021, punished a widow who remarried within a year of her husband's death by loss of dower as well as of other property.
While varied, nowhere did the laws afford daughters, sisters, mothers, and wives a position of economic equality within the family. Nelson and Rio suggest that the very different ways kings and princes, and almost always men, responded to applying practical solutions to legal interpretation led to a, quote, fundamentally ambiguous and conflicted place for women in the early medieval society and family. Both a highly prized asset and a crucial form of symbolic capital on the one hand, but also a heavy financial burden, a liability, and a weakness in men's safeguarding of their honor. Significantly, though, Nelson and Robb show that while varied, what the diverse legal codes across Western Europe did not demonstrate is that there was a golden age for women's economic or political status in the early medieval period that was eroded in the late medieval and early modern period.
But more than the lack of a golden age transformative moment to something worse, what the early medieval laws across these kingdoms show is that lawmakers were worried about how to control women, how to make sure women, who by customs of the era had less economic power, were provided for, and how the burden of women should be shared between and within families. Though there are fewer studies of women's wage labor for this time period, what is clear is that there were still continuities in European customs regarding how those in power, men, understood and devalued women.
The legal customs and actual law codes that marked women as lesser, inferior, in need of paternalistic protection, if for no other reason than the broader disenfranchisement and economic sidelining that the broader system created, persisted for centuries. Even as we inch towards closing the gender wage gap today, these broader social and cultural beliefs about women are still pretty evident. And I'm sure you can all think of many examples in the media, on your Facebook feed, whatever.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like on my Facebook feed that I still have people who are from my hometown. And they'll be like, oh, this trans girl was on the soccer team and the soccer team won. And then they'll be like, oh, this is an outrage. We have to protect our daughters and sisters from boys who are dressed up like girls and competing in sports. And I'm like, bitch, please. I'll beat you in softball. I'll beat you in basketball. Like, I don't need no boy, no man, no brother to stand up against.
Protect you.
Yeah. Don't need it.
Too much.
It's too the rage.
You gotta start unfollowing people.
I know. I mean, I don't follow that person, but I follow a friend who is friends with him, and then I see it up on my page. Also, sometimes those people are also my own brothers.
Bless your heart.
Bless their pea-picking hearts. And the system of patriarchal paternalism, like that exacted by sometimes my brothers in our group chats, certainly persisted throughout Western Europe in the early modern period. In 1868, Edmund Tilly summed up the gendered ideas about the household economy with, quote, "The office of the husband is to go abroad in matters of profit. Of the wife, well, to keep them. The office of the husband is to go abroad in matters of profit. Of the wife, to tarry at home and see all be well there. The office of the husband is to provide the money. Of the wife, not wastefully to spend it. The office of the husband is to be lord of all. Of the wife, to give account of all." In addition to showcasing the way men's labor was quantified and women's labor was valueless, I think Tilly's hitting on another point of continuity that fits in with these broader social, cultural, and legal ideas about women. If I gave you that quote and asked you to date it, I bet you'd guess it was written in the 19th century rather than in the 16th, because we have this idea that industrialization and shifting gender roles turned the household economy into just a household and moved economic means of production into the public sphere. But as Tilly's 16th century ponderings demonstrate, the gender division of public and private predated both industrialization and the Victorian era. While, as Sarah Rees-Jones shows, the gendered norms about spatial conduct were often contradicted and ignored from early in the Middle Ages, there were gendered understandings about domestic and public spaces. One was valued for its reproductive function in creating families, the other, of course, for its reproductive function in providing the material needs for the other. They were mutually reliant, but only one carried economic value.
In the 18th century, two sets of ideas shaped the concept of womanhood: Christianity and Enlightenment thinkers, with, unfortunately, Rousseau's ideas dominating the conversation. Though, of course, Mary Wollstonecraft and Olympe de Gouges contributed their rebuttals to this misogynist perspective that dominated the salons of the Enlightenment era, the most influential Enlightenment thinkers promoted particularly narrow ideas about what a woman was capable of and thus worth.
Take Rousseau's description of the fictional Sophie, the archetype of woman in his understanding of the world. Quote, and bear with me because Rousseau makes me really angry. Hopefully it doesn't come through my voice. "Except for her sex, woman is like a man. In whatever way one looks at them, the difference is only one of degree. Yet where sex is concerned, woman and man are both complementary and different. These similarities and differences must have an influence on morals. This effect is apparent and conforms with experience, and shows the futility of the disputes over the superiority or the equality of the sexes. In the union of the sexes, each alike contributes to the common end, though in different ways. From this diversity springs the first difference that may be observed between man and woman in their moral relations. One should be strong and active, the other weak and passive. One must necessarily have both the power and the will. It is sufficient for the other to offer little resistance. This principle being established, it follows that woman was specifically made to please man. If man ought to please her in turn, the necessity is less direct. His merit lies in his power. He pleases simply because he is strong. I grant you this is not the law of love, but it is the law of nature, which is older than love itself."
Rousseau offers this description of Sophie and the feminine archetype as a foil for his description of how a young man should be educated, with lots of experiential learning and communing with nature. Significantly, in Rousseau's opinion, to educate a woman in anything other than the womanly arts and domestic work would be a waste of time, for she is not only incapable of thinking the way a man can, but it would distract her from her quote-unquote natural inclinations. And here then we see Rousseau blending the Judeo-Christian customs regarding gender roles in society and applying his theories to the quote-unquote natural rights and roles.
The combination of Christianity and Enlightenment ideas was that there was a natural woman who was limited in her legal, social, economic, and educational abilities, and thus in need of a protector. The logic here was that in an industrialized society where the labor was heavy or robust, the physically weaker female body should be relegated to domestic pursuits. According to Ada von Knigg, writing in 1788 Hanover, quote, the female sex was to remain as much excluded from involvement in the bourgeois public sphere as they were from the world of employment, and politics was certainly out of bounds. Women's exclusive domain was the household or the family.
Similarly, writing in 1765, Englishman John Brown, vicar of Newcastle upon Tyne, wrote, quote, one, that the female frame of person and mind tends chiefly to fit and qualify the sex for domestic life only, and two, that from this frame of person and mind, conducted by a suitable education, the female virtues prescribed by Christianity do naturally arise, end quote. Consistent in purpose and effect from the very early medieval period, and presumably arising out of late antiquity, Christianity, and Judaism, gendered roles were translated into economic value and worthlessness.
And I wonder sometimes reading these as used as evidence in like medievalist tracts about customs and the way people in the 18th century or early modernists, how they thought about gender and women's capabilities. If this is just like the trolls or like the incels of their society saying these things. But then on the other hand, the evidence of things like the wage gap clearly show that even if these are like the people who are expressing the most, I don't know, extremist views about gender, their ideas end up being what reflect what's actually happening. And the trolls of today are just saying what everyone is thinking.
Right. And quote unquote knowing. Yeah, that's an astute observation.
Yeah. Also makes me rage. Bennett and numerous other scholars, including Penelope Lane, argue that the wage gap in Western Europe from the 14th century to the 19th century was simply customary, ideological, rather than accidental or based on market value wages. Women's wages, like men's wages, certainly fluctuated in response to labor shortages and other economic forces. But the fact that women were usually paid lower wages was because that was the custom. As one 13th century treatise advised, estate managers should hire women for certain tasks because she could be relied on to work for, quote, much less money than a man would take.
Significantly, the kinds of work women did or were expected to do are also part of those long-term trends. In both 1380 and throughout the 17th century, two-fifths of all single women worked in domestic service, and one-third worked in textile or clothing manufacturing. As we discussed in my episode earlier in the series, this was generally true after industrialization and the rise of capitalism, too. According to Judith Bennett and Peter Earle, writing about the 14th and 18th centuries respectively, the distribution of unmarried women into types of work, including care work, were remarkably similar across the centuries. In Southwark, England in 1381, 38% of women were employed in domestic service, while in London between 1695 and 1725, 39.8% of women were in domestic service. In 1381, 12.3% of women worked in clothing making or mending, and 17.9% did the same kind of work in 18th century London.
What's also interesting, however, is the ways that women were pushed out of industries once they were industrialized and waged in more systematic and consistent ways. For example, in the 14th century, 17.2% of women were engaged in textile manufacture. By the 18th century, only 3.6% of the women were able to find waged work in textile manufacture. Like the Brewsters in the 14th century, who were pushed out of the industry by men who saw economic opportunity after the Black Plague, we should not overlook the ways that the patriarchy oppresses women. In these cases of waged work, but also more broadly, patriarchy is reinforced and expressed in the men who make laws that govern women's ability to work, make decisions for their bodies, or participate in public life, and men who issue religious and moral edicts about what is appropriate behavior for women, who gets to use what bathrooms, or what role a woman should play in a household or a relationship.
In both the 18th and the 14th centuries, married women worked in many of the same occupations as single women, except domestic service, and more married women worked in victualling. Across all of these occupations, no matter what work they did, it was regarded as low-skilled, yielded low remuneration, and by necessity was combined easily with a wide variety of other work. Women could not get by just doing one full-time job, if they could find, quote-unquote, full-time work, because that was not compensated at a rate commensurate with that of their male counterparts.
According to Peter Earle, who compared his data in the late 17th century and early 18th century to the 1851 census, so the 19th century, the conditions he'd found among wage women workers persisted into the 19th century. He notes that, quote, "the general structure of occupations was very similar in both periods, with the top four employments of women unchanged." And we can see this still today, of course. Professions that became associated with women, like teaching, nursing, and various cleaning work, have long been underpaid. And even as those professions, coded as feminine, are underpaid, when men take those jobs, they tend to earn higher wages than their female counterparts. In one 2004 study, male nurses on average earned a higher wage premium than women as they entered or were given management or got into anesthetic nursing. Similarly, among teachers, men on average receive higher wages than women and dominate better paid administrator positions. In 2020 to 2021, women in the U.S. were 56% of all principals in public schools, but only 35.5% of high school principals, which is a more prestigious and better paid, often, position.
Bennett notes that the consistent devaluation of their labor and work from 1350 to 1700 and beyond, and broader English and European treatment of women did not make for, as Peter Fleming put it, a story of unalloyed gloom and repression. By Bennett's estimation, though women faced considerable economic obstacles and were rarely allowed to make enough money at one occupation to provide for their families, most were able to piece together enough to support themselves and their loved ones. Many were undoubtedly satisfied with their lives and social roles. Some may have even prospered. Quote, "with a good husband and a happy marriage, a woman could achieve a satisfying working life. But such personal egalitarianism, when or even if it existed, was shadowed by inequality, for the husband's power remained in reserve, not fully yielded. With an indifferent husband or an abusive marriage, a woman could find herself a sort of servant to her husband or even cast aside altogether."
And this was not a phenomenon specific to England either. Pilar Benito and José García Gómez repeat the assertion that the Industrial Revolution opened up unprecedented opportunities for women to enter the labor market and carry out paid work. As Bennett points out, while true, the greater availability of wage jobs did not translate into a significant closing of the gender wage gap or a shift in the valuation of women's labor. The patriarchal economic systems of Europe from 1360 East Riding, England to 1860 Alcoy, Spain, even when there were exceptions to general rules, were largely consistent and oppressive to women.
Working women experienced changes between 1350 and 2000, the shift from medieval to modern, but not transformation. The changes were things like fluctuations in real wages, differentials between skilled and unskilled waged labor, and brief periods of ordinances denying women guild membership, ephemeral and often impacting only a small minority of women. Cities grew, capitalism changed the relationship that people had to waged labor, new kinds of skilled and unskilled wage occupations developed, but in the long durée of European history, the wage gap continued, with women earning between 50 to 75% of men's wages, including for doing the same work, a gap that was further complicated by race and class in this period. Capitalism and the modern economy did not transform women's work, for better or worse. As Bennett put it, quote, "medieval women's work was no paradise, nor, for that matter, an inferno. It was instead, in some broad respects, remarkably similar to women's work today."
Feminist historians have pointed to the rise of capitalism as a particularly transformative moment in working women's lives, based on the mythology that in the pre-modern system, labor was more egalitarian and women's contributions to the household economy were more highly valued than the out-of-home labor market of capitalism. But Bennett and others, as we've demonstrated in this episode, have shown that this was not the case. Bennett's book, History Matters, seeks to complicate the way that historians, including feminist historians, look at history, with or without rose-colored glasses. Not to suggest that capitalism had a positive impact on working women, because it didn't, as Elizabeth already demonstrated in the series, but that when we look at the long durée of working European women, their labor has been devalued for hundreds of years, and conditions like the gender wage gap have wavered in the same demeaning range for almost 800 years. Probably really longer, because we're not even talking about the early medieval period.
Bennett notes that feminists, including feminist historians, seem more comfortable with recording transformations, big leaps of progress and improvement in the lives of the oppressed and marginalized. Perhaps because if we can reveal change in the past, we can hope for change in our own futures. Or, as Elizabeth Fox Genovese put it, quote, historians love to find traditional society in all its reassuring stability in the century that preceded the one that they are studying. Yeah, and that's particularly, I think, true for Americanists, right? But Bennett reminds us the so-called traditional woman probably never existed any more than some sort of golden age for women did. Even each of these views in their own way contains elements of modernization, implying that there is a continual progression to the modern age. Such an orientation in historical writing is dangerous and misleading. It suggests, first, that there is something perfect and resolved in our own age, which events hardly justify, and second, tends to ignore the variations not only over time but across regions, which make it obvious that there is not just one route to the present, nor is the view of the past so simple.
It is true, of course, that not all women's experiences of these laws, customs, and social expectations were the same. Aristocratic women, for example, played a crucial role in preserving and transferring family wealth through marriage gifts and inheritance in the medieval and early modern period. Despite coverture and earlier Anglo-Saxon laws that sought to empower patrilineal lines and concentrate economic power into men's hands, the Domesday Book records 350 women, mostly women who, quote, held landed estates in 1066, accounting for 5% of total lands. And according to Jane Whittle, 10 to 14% of smaller landowners were women. We have few records of day-to-day life in medieval Europe, so it's hard to quantify or even qualify how these customs, laws, and trends were felt by medieval or even early modern Europeans. The exceptions, though, often prove the rule, so most women were inevitably negatively impacted by these systems and felt the pressure and exhaustion from having to cobble together a living from side hustles while also managing the family and keeping house.
The gendered wage gap has persisted to this day. In the UK, the government started tracking the gender wage gap in the 1920s. Feminists in the 1970s and 1980s celebrated the slowly closing gap between men and women's wages, which went from 50% to 75% in a seemingly short period of time. Bennett points out that far from being a transformation in the valuation of women's work and labor, the gender wage gap replicated the same range that had persisted in Europe for centuries. Rather than pointing to systematic change, the fluctuation was indistinguishable from any other century, with the end result, a lesser valuation of women's labor in comparison to men's, being the same.
Today in Britain and Northern Ireland, women make almost 85% of what men make. That number is about on par with the rest of Europe, plus or minus a few percentage points. Based on the calculations Bennett synthesized in History Matters, which was published in the early 2000s, this moment we're living in is the best women have ever done in wage labor. Still not equal pay for equal work. And notably, the 2023 report notes that while 86% of men were in full-time positions, only 61% of women were in full-time positions, which accounts for at least part of the real wage gap. But overall, this is a modest improvement in the real wages, and one that seems to have broken free, maybe, of the 50 to 75% range that Bennett and other medievalists identified for the previous 700 years.
Significantly, of course, what the numerically closing wage gap does not quantify is the actual distribution of labor, the types of work that women are encouraged to do or expected to do, and or that become gendered as, quote, feminine and thus compensated lower, and the overwhelming gendering of uncompensated care work and domestic labor. These are shared experiences of women today with women in the 8th, 14th, 18th, and early 20th century. The gender wage gap and the gendering of waged and unwaged labor more broadly are continuities that can help us, for better or worse, better understand the past.
In some ways, the way our patriarchal world makes us feel may well be feelings shared by women of the past. Maybe they didn't have the language for it, but one needn't even imagine the feelings of rage, insufficiency, and exclusion over men's weaponized incompetence, fathers who are such good dads for babysitting their own children, mansplaining, and the emotional and intellectual exhaustion of running an entire household while also working full or part-time to ensure our families are solvent. Like the wage gap itself, these are products of patriarchy. It has been the custom, shored up by law, religion, and culture, to treat women as inferior to men, whether we're talking about our status as wage earners or as members of society. As Judith Bennett reminds us, patriarchy is the oppression of women. So rise and resist, and for f***'s sake, vote.
Oh, God, that just gave me f***ing chills, and I'm mad as hell. No, speaking to the credit cards, I mean, I remember, like, I'm older than you guys, and I remember going with my mom to, like, pay for credit cards or, like, pay a balance, open up a credit card, and always having to come with something that is signed by my father. Like, I remember that, this is not a long time ago.
Right.
But anyway, yeah. When does it get better?
Well, I won't tell you my answer.
Yeah, I know. And that's the thing. Like, how do you have a family, right? Like, I'm about to cry.
Don't cry. It's okay. But you can cry if you want.
But, like, how do you do it?
How do you have a family and also reclaim your power? Well, then we need to change the system.
Right. Which gets back to your vote.
Fucking vote. We can't go backwards. And I know it's already too late to change the Democratic nomination and nobody's excited about Joe Biden. But we just can't go backwards any further than we have already gone. Or we're just going to end up right back in that 50 to 75% range. It's only a matter of fucking time. Back in the cycle.
I have nothing to say to that. As always, we invite you to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at @dig_history or join our Facebook group, Dig History Pod Squad. If you have a comment or question or want to share some kinds of kind words with us, you can always email us at hello@digpodcast.org. We love listener mail. If you're an educator, we've got a compendium of episodes that you can use in the classroom and free teaching resources, including full lesson plans on our website at digpodcast.org. We realize that recent changes to curriculum in states like Florida and Texas will complicate being able to use our podcast episodes in the classroom. So please reach out if there's something we can do to be helpful to you and your classroom. You'll always find full bibliographies, the scripts for all of our episodes, resources, and a link to our swag store at digpodcast.org.
And if you can't hear the rage in Elizabeth's voice, then you aren't listening. So with that, thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening. This was a fucking badass episode, April. Thank you for writing it.
You're welcome. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
This podcast was produced by the historians of Dig, Elizabeth Garner Masaryk, Sarah Hanley Cousins, Marissa Rhodes, and me, Avril Earls. Thanks for listening. The Gender Gate.
Similarly and complementarily. So in other words, as outlined in the treaties, guilds, a foundation of the late medieval economy, I said that weird, and one third of everything. So the couple had worked in
Vittling.
Oh, vittling, is that food service? Can I just say food service?
No, it's vittling. Say it. And as we can see, this still,
I did my taxes yesterday. I bring home the bacon in this family, right? And I have like 20,000 side hustles, right? Like I've always got something in the pot. And yet I do our taxes yesterday and who's head of household? Who's TurboTax talking to and asking questions of as I'm doing the effing work? Like, oh, it just, because I love my husband. I love him. He is a great dad. You know, like what the what do you do in this situation, right? Like when you're just you're second class, really.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm kind of losing it.
No, this is the rage that we have to feel.
Yeah.
This is the rage that women felt in 1780. This is the rage they felt in 1850 and 1848, the range they felt in 1960, right? Like, and it's, I think it's not until we like track these longer trends and see that shared rage across centuries that we can like get to the root of the problems, right? It's that longer history. This is what Bennett is essentially arguing, is that there's, that if we just look in our immediate past and like, oh, let's celebrate our, oh, we get credit cards now. That's a huge victory.
Right. I'm not quick on my feet in speaking. I got to write this out. I got to go write.
No, it was, I love the raw passion of it. Also, you're right. And I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, and the thing is, it's a small thing. It doesn't matter. It doesn't change my income. But it does, right? Like, it's so symbolic.
It's emblematic of a larger systemic problem.
Right.
And you're fucking white, so.
Yeah, exactly. I'm white. I'm middle class. I come from parents who, you know, we're still married and love each other. You know, like I have tons of white privilege. So, yeah.